All right, well, Sahil, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I imagine you're doing quite a few of these at the moment.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, definitely. My November, December has quite a few of these.
How many have you got in your diary?
I think 40, something like that.
Does it get repetitive telling the same story again and again?
It's repetitive, but you know, not in any way that I don't mind. It's fun to kind of, you know, I think you improve. It's kind of like pitching a startup. I think it's repetitive, but hopefully you're getting better over time and you're finding out what resonates. And I think it's really important, actually. I think it's been fun to kind of play with different ways of communicating the same message and seeing what resonates, what doesn't resonate, and things like that. So yeah, I think it is repetitive, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing.
So look, I thought we'd maybe start by hearing a bit about you. So tell me a bit about your background. Where did you grow up?
Yeah, so I grew up in Singapore primarily, was born in New York, but mostly grew up in Singapore. And then I moved back to the States in 2010, I think, to go to college at USC. So I've kind of considered myself, I guess, American, but grew up abroad most of the time.
Right. What was it like growing up in Singapore?
It was great. Super safe, super clean. One thing that I think Singapore has, I don't know how the rest of the world is kind of evolved on this, but it was like cool to be smart and good at school culturally, which I think is important if you want people to be smart and good at school. And so I was able to, like, you know, for example, like learn iPhone app development and stuff. And that wasn't really seen as like, oh, this guy's a nerd, like we should bully him or whatever, you know?
Right.
So I think that was nice, but it was, yeah. I mean, I honestly don't have much to compare it to, so I don't know how growing up in any other country would really be. But I enjoyed it, and I think it was like a nice kind of playground to live in for you know my upbringing. I don't know if I would ever live there again, though. I vastly prefer the U.S.
How come?
It's just boring. I mean, Singapore is just not. There's not a lot of stuff going on. I think creatively. I think the food is amazing. It's like amazing weather. There's a bunch of reasons to live there, but it's not innovation. Innovation is not one of them. I think if you care about that kind of stuff, and you know, like what I spend my time doing is hanging out with creators and writing and painting and drawing, and you know, hanging out with entrepreneurs and investing in startups and these sorts of things. Like, I just think that obviously with remote, it's getting better and better everywhere, but I still think the U.S. is kind of bar none in terms of the quality and quantity of people wanting to do that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Do you think there's a different culture in the U.S. that's more towards that sort of stuff as well?
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of this comes down to the First Amendment, you know, like the U.S. has something that basically no other country has, which is, you know, I can say anything and without any real fear of repercussion. Like the UK doesn't have this, Singapore doesn't have this, Norway doesn't have this, like very few countries, obviously China, North Korea don't have this. But I think that is really the sort of ground truth that brings everybody to the United States. Like, I think everything else is based off of the ability to say whatever you want. That tends to attract kind of extreme personalities because they want to be able to say that sort of stuff without fear. And those extreme personalities end up, you know, some of them end up building Tesla, you know? So
yeah,
I really believe that, like, that the sort of cultural component of America really stems from that decision that was made a long time ago that, to my knowledge, has like rarely been made since.
Yeah, I agree. There's a frontier mindset, isn't there, in everyone that goes there. And those,
yeah,
who
it's
live
like
there,
a wild, it's a wild, wild west. You know, I think, like, I wouldn't move to the U.S. if I wanted to just have like a mediocre life. Like, there are probably better countries in the world that have better social welfare programs and public transport. But if you believe in capitalism and freedom, and you think you can kind of, you know, you social mobility, et cetera, I think there's a lot of opportunity here for that. But the more opportunity there is to scale upwards, it also means there's you know, when, you know, obviously these are not zero sum games, but there's some level of people who lose out as well, right? It's not, not like everyone wins in this model.
Yes. Yeah. I think it sits somewhat at the extremes, but I guess some people want to take that risk and others don't.
Yeah.
And I guess on this subject, you got started on your entrepreneurial journey fairly early, right? I read somewhere you bought and sold a company when you were 14, like a video service.
Yeah. Yeah. Like maybe not a company, but a website. I sold on, you know, there are these kind of I think they still exist today. There are these marketplaces where you can kind of list really tiny websites. Like SitePoint was the name of the marketplace. I think it rebranded to Flippa, and I have no idea what they're doing now, but maybe they're still around. They're probably still around. But yeah, I would basically build these websites when I was like 13, 14 years old. They just solved small problems in my life, and, you know, over the course of a weekend or something like that. And then I would try to get a bunch of traffic to it just by emailing bloggers and trying to get them to pick it up. And most of the time someone would. And then sort of the next weekend or so, I would basically sell the business for, you know, a few $1,000 or sometimes more, but generally around a few $1,000, and then start a new thing and do it again and again and again and again. Just like, you know, quite a few times. So yeah, that was my business model. That was my way of buying kind of Xbox games as a kid.
Right. You must have been able to buy a lot of Xbox games, man.
Yeah, it turns out that there's like 5 that are worth playing. And like after I got those, I was like, okay, it turns out, I guess it's, you know, it takes like an insane amount of money and time to make a really great game. So there's just not that many of them. And then I got I started getting motivated for different reasons. I didn't need the Xbox games when I was, you know, 17 or 18 or whatever.
Mm. And then you decided to move to the US. You got a place in college at USC, but you ended up dropping out pretty quickly, right?
Yeah. So I moved to the US in 2010, fully intending to graduate, you know, getting my 4-year kind of university degree. And, you know, the kind of the standard track, right? Like you do a couple startup internships, and then by the end, you hopefully get an offer from Facebook or Google or something like that. And then you do that for a while, and then you join a startup, and then you do that for a while, and then you start a company. Like that was kind of my trajectory. And yeah, it just happened like a lot faster than I was expecting. Yeah, within like a couple months, a bunch of startups started reaching out to me, kind of White Combinator startups primarily, saying, hey, you know, we need an iPhone app. You know, it looks like you know how to make iPhone apps. Like, do you want a job, basically?
Interesting.
And that was pretty mind-boggling to me that, like, you know, I was 18, I think, at the time. And, you know, these startups that I wanted to, you know, I thought I'd had to work at Google for 5 years or something to qualify or whatever. Like, there, you know, it was, I could do that then, you know? And so it kind of was like, well, then what's the, like, what am I paying USC for, right? Yes. Like, if I... presumably you're paying them to get the job, but if I, or, you know, get the skills, I guess, to get the job, or, you know, a combination of both. So yeah, if I already had the skills to get the job, then, you know, yeah, I could save 5 years of my life. So that's kind of how I did the math on it, which seemed to work out.
And you, so they just found you, what, like online? Were you like writing stuff on Twitter at the time? Like, how did they sort of discover you?
Yeah. So, I mean, I got into a habit pretty early. Like part of what I was doing, I guess not exactly when I started doing the building and selling of websites, but when I moved to the US, actually, I think it was, I was like, okay, I need to like network with these kinds of people. They're not around me physically. And so I started a blog, and I basically just said, I'm going to blog, like, I think it was like twice a week or something, really, really short, you know, 300 word things, like, and I would write something, and then I would put it on Hacker News. So I would, you know, kind of like, for folks who may not know that, basically it's like a Reddit, but only for, you know, kind of startups, basically. Actually, I think Reddit might've been modeled after it, but in the back of the day, but or vice versa, I'm not sure. But yeah, basically I just blog and post my thoughts, and, you know, people would go to Hacker News. They would, you know, every startup founder then, but also I would assume most people now, like, go to Hacker News, you know, every day or so. And so when you show up a few times, people kind of recognize your name, reach out. That's kind of how it happened.
Right. And then you ended up being what, the second employee at Pinterest doing engineering?
Yeah, I was a second employee at Pinterest, mostly in charge of building Pinterest for iPhone.
Right. But pretty quickly you decided, hey, I've got an idea, built it over a weekend and started Gumroad, right?
Yeah. So I joined Pinterest I guess I started working with them in like August or October of 2010. So pretty soon after I joined USC. It was kind of my like side project in college. And then, in 2011, moved up to the Bay Area. And then by April, I think I had the idea for Gumroad. And, you know, just like I'd been building and selling those website ideas in middle school, high school, like I never really stopped. Like I'd just been building different things since. And especially actually when I got to the US, I kind of doubled down on learning Python and you know, Stripe had come out, or no, I guess Stripe hadn't come out, but I knew about Stripe through John. And so I kind of had, I was like, oh, what, you know, what does easy payments processing do to the landscape, right? What other ideas can I build? And yeah, so Gumroad was kind of one of those ideas that I had built kind of one weekend and got excited about. And
You shared on Hacker News, it got a lot of hits, and you decided, okay, I'm gonna go build this. You raised some money pretty quickly. And I guess you cover a lot of this in your blog post, right? Reflecting on my failure to build a $1 billion company. Maybe you can give us a run through of the first few years.
Yeah, totally. So that was April 2011. I just kind of kept working on it as a side project or something, for like 6 months. I don't know if it, like, how much real traction it had beyond the, you know, the initial bump of interest. I think conceptually it was kind of a compelling idea to kind of many people, especially kind of the Hacker News crowd. You know, we were talking about like Bitcoin and stuff at the time,
right?
Back when it was like 70 cents, I think, around that range. And yeah, I kind of just had it as a side project. I was still working at Pinterest, and then eventually, you know, investors started reaching out. I had conversations with the Pinterest team, and I basically realized, like, I would much rather build a company. And that when you want to do that, when you realize that, like, nothing really can compete with that, you know, it's kind of a singular experience, I think. So yeah, in sort of fall of 2011, I left Pinterest before my stock vested, unfortunately, but left Pinterest, started Gumroad in, I think, September 27th was like the official incorporation date or something like that. Raised a seed round of funding, a $1.1 million seed round, and then raised a Series A from Kleiner in sort of early 2012, I think May or something like that. So it's kind of pretty fast from, like, you know, moving to the Bay Area, maybe even moving to the US and kind of being in that position to have a kind of a Series A funded startup. And then, you know, I did kind of what every startup does, which is, you know, you hire a few people and you try to get to product market fit by,
right,
you know, shipping features and talking to customers and doing that over and over again until, you know, you kind of don't have to grow. Right.
Right. And you're still like 19 at this stage, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think I was 19.
Pretty crazy. So you've raised a ton of money from Kleiner. You're trying to grow. Then by the time you hit sort of 2014 or so, you're sort of running out of money, right? And maybe not hitting the growth rates that you'd hope for.
Yeah, well, you know, definitely we weren't hitting the growth rates that we were hoping for, but I did believe that we were growing and, you know, our kind of trajectory was up and to the right, and, you know, eventually the creator economy would blossom and we'd be in a, you know, well situated to do really well in it. And that kind of happened, I think.
Yeah, but I guess you guys are quite certainly early to the game in terms of the creator economy as a term or idea, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were literally the first company to ever say creator economy. In 2015 is when we started, I think, using the word or the term. And I don't think we kind of had to come up with it because we needed a way to describe this thing. And yeah, it just didn't really exist. You know, it was basically called influencers on YouTube back then,
right.
Not creators. So we kind of knew going into the conversations in 2015, early 2015, late 2014, that it was going to be pretty difficult, but I didn't really realize, like, oh wow, this is, VCs are actually much more momentum driven than I was expecting, basically. Which maybe is different now, I don't know, the markets have changed quite a bit, but yeah, I was just kind of sad that, like, oh, it turns out that, you know, by this point we needed really strong numbers, really strong compounding month over month growth, and if we don't have those things, then it honestly doesn't matter. Like, you know, I say right. this kind of in the post, like, it doesn't matter how awesome your team is, you know, how fast you ship features, all of the sort of the things that around quality don't really matter. Like, what matters is, like, you know, how fast are you growing?
How fast are you growing?
It kind of becomes a that at least matters, you know, more than anything else, right? Like, it's kind of a logarithmic curve, and that's kind of at the head of the curve.
So yeah, I think I saw a podcast with Jason Calacanis where you talked about this, and you know, you sort of spoke to one of the partners at Benchmark, and they said, "Great product, great team, you guys are fucked."
Yeah,
so which, basically, pretty tough thing to hear. And then you managed to get some sort of a bridge round of funding from Kleiner at pretty horrible terms, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're debatable. I personally don't think they're horrible. Some people right. believe they were. But yeah, basically they gave us a bridge round of $2 million at a 4x liquidation preference, which, especially in today's market, is pretty uncommon, but might have been more common back then.
Right. I guess horrible is the wrong term, but, you know, very favorable to the investor. But what you had available at the time, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, you know, what are the options, right? Ultimately, it's a free market, and people can offer the terms, and you take what you get, right? So if you need it, you know, maybe that's a mistake that I made, is that we didn't really have an alternative pathway, right? Like, we kind of, maybe there would have been a way out, but if we didn't raise the money, it would have been, I think, a lot more painful. And, you know, truthfully, like, Kleiner ended up writing off their whole investment, which included that $2 million bridge round, right?
In 2017. So
it ended up zeroing out anyway.
They sold it back to you for a dollar, right?
Yeah, exactly. All the money they put in.
But between 2014 and when that happened in 2017, it sounds like a pretty tough time. You had to lay off a lot of your employees. It sounds like you also sort of, it was quite a struggle mentally in terms of what you'd set yourself up for as your vision of success, and then where you were, how you compared yourself to your peers, all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, I, you know, in 2015, I think it was October or November of 2015, we downsized the company. This was, you know, not a surprise to anybody. We kind of knew it was going to be tough, and we raced that bridge in, I think, January. And so it kind of gave us like 9 months to really figure this out with our existing team. Maybe in hindsight, I should have like shrunk the team down by half anyway, or something like that, to give us like double the runway. But it was kind of like, look, if we can't figure this thing out in like 9 months, like, we're just not going to, right? Like, what's left for us to try? And, you know, ultimately, I think the other sort of nuance that I don't really get into the blog post too much, because it really wasn't about this, but is just the fact that, you know, employees want growth too, right? Like, everyone talks about how VCs want growth, but the truth is, like, all your employees want growth too. Actually, maybe more badly, because they don't have a portfolio that VCs do. And they can, you know, so like, if you're, you know, it's not like, oh, I can just turn Gumroad into a bootstrap business and then everyone would stay, right? Like, no. And so, yeah
they've all got their options. They want a exactly. big exit.
Exactly.
Their bet is you, essentially. I mean, what was crazy to me was when you sort of scaled back, your growth just continued at the same rate. And then I think I saw you sort of wrote about this elsewhere, but, you know, it doesn't really matter how amazing your product is or whatever, the market you're in is what's determining your growth rate mainly.
Yeah, I would say so. At least it provides, you know, if I wanted to be more precise with my language, I probably would have said like it sort of provides the ceiling. Right. Mm-hmm. So within the market, you can kind of only grow as fast as the market, you know, has space for you to grow. But yeah, it's roughly true, and actually that is the line that resonated, like, it kind of goes viral every once in a while on Twitter. Because I think a lot of people realize that, like, it's kind of a harsh truth to face, because it basically says, like, you know, you're not useful, right? Like, you built this, and not just you, but maybe even like your team or whatever, right? Like you, I mean, it's also, I mean, it's, you know, two sides of the same coin. On one hand, you're not useful, but on the other hand, you build something that doesn't actually need you anymore, right? Like, maybe that's awesome. But yeah, it kind of gives you a feeling of helplessness, right? Like, oh, and that's what we learned in that 9-month period where we really tried to make the company grow faster. We shipped like a stupid amount of features. Like, you know, I still have very high confidence that like the Gumroad team back then was like, you know, world-class, one of the best teams I've ever assembled. Even today, I can look back and say that. And we have great people now too. But we've always shipped, you know, super fast. I think we have a pretty high quality product. It just, we never hit the market in the way that it needed us to. And then by the time the creator economy really took off, which, you know, with Teachable, I think started in 2015. And, you know, obviously like Substack, I think started in 2017, 2018. I'm, you know, I still think Gumroad is actually bigger than Substack, but in terms of GMV and revenue and stuff, but it's a tough. So, you know, I think the funny thing is like, some people are like, oh, well, you know, you were wrong. The creator economy is actually massive. And it's like, well, actually I'm still right.
Which you're is still like, doing all right, man.
Yeah. I mean, I redefined success, right. Which is kind of the point of the essay is that, you know, it turns out you can build a $10 million a year business and that's still really great, but the creator economy still is, you know, it's still important if you are trying to build a massive company that you know, you pick a market that can support it, right? And the creator economy just does not have the capacity at this point to build, you know, a $100 billion company within. It just doesn't exist yet. So
right. And maybe it will in future. It definitely feels like, you know, people are saying it moves in that direction. And I guess it all depends. But look, I let's dig into sort of the new philosophy and what you learned from all of this, which I guess is what, you know, your book, The Minimalist Entrepreneur, is about, and, you know, this sort of philosophy of minimalist entrepreneurship. I guess one of my questions when I read this, if you were to do this all again, sort of starting from zero, but imagine you didn't have the network and reputation you have now, but just had your knowledge, how would that affect the way you'd build the business? Would you still consider raising venture funding?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I think my playbook, kind of like my past, sort of applies here, right? Which is like, I didn't start my first company and raise venture funding for it, right? Mm. Like, I started building mini businesses when I was 14, right? And selling them. And so by the time I moved to the Bay, I mean, the reason, you know, that I was able to kind of raise the Series A at 19 years old and be employee number two at Pinterest and all these sorts of things was because I was not new, you know, in a way.
Right. Like, right. It's actually not like had 5 years of experience doing this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I think sometimes people are like, oh, you skipped the line. And it's like, well, no, I just joined the line when I was 14, you know? And right. So by the time I was 18, I was, you know, I basically had a 4-year university degree in the sense that I built stuff. Yes. And so that, I think, you know, it's kind of funny. Like, I think one of the things that I can do a better job with the book is like, I actually think it's a great playbook to build massive unicorn companies. It's just that path is not accessible to most people. So it's not really what I focused on, but Stripe, Tesla, Elon, I think are total examples of the minimalist entrepreneur playbook in terms of starting small, getting the profitability, building something for a small, you know, sort of insular group of people first, and then expanding from there, right? Stripe with kind of the YC batch, and they had a company before Stripe, Octomatic, and Elon had multiple companies before Tesla and SpaceX, yeah. You know, one of which is called Zip2, which was like an internet file sharing kind of service, right? That he kind of bootstrapped, basically, or, you know, chose an idea that he could bootstrap. I think it's sort of, yeah, I would say definitely you want to build stuff. It definitely helps. Like it does make it easier to, you know, for example, even the book is, you know, it's published by Penguin Random House, right? And so I think it's important to think strategically about how do you get to the next level in your career, growth, what have you. But the book is written for everybody. And most people just don't have those kinds of opportunities, right? Most people cannot raise venture capital or get published by a random house.
Or perhaps don't have the desire to. as well, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the sacrifices exactly. that come with it. And, you know, I mean, you write, you know, about having been venture back, the stress and working 16-hour days and all that sort of thing. And like, you know, people have other priorities in life. And I think one of the things that...
Yeah, most people do not want that, for sure.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's interesting here, you know, you talk about starting with community, and then the MVP bit, right? And sort of building processes rather than products. I think there's so many tools out there now that make all of this so much easier, even than when you were first doing this, right? You think about Airtable and then communities on Reddit, or, you know, building community on Slack or Discord or whatever it is. You know, the opportunity is sort of all around us for anyone to start, you know, a small sort of internet-based business, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think ultimately, like, you know, it's another kind of double-edged sword. The easier it gets for you, the easier it gets for everybody else, right? So you're always going to have more competition. So, you know, you should start sort of ASAP, because it's only going to get more competitive over time as more people can do these sorts of things. You know, democratization is great, but like, for example, like, would I be able to do what I did in 2011? I think so. I still think there's like a dearth of iOS engineers, and startups are still trying to hire them like crazy, but it's a different world today, right? And so, yeah, I think sort of in these expansive industries that are growing quite quickly, like, you want to start as soon as possible. So, yeah, but I definitely think, yeah, like, compared to, I mean, the way that we run Gummer today is really only, I would say, if I had to put a time stamp on it, like, would only be possible sort of like 2018 or something like that onwards, with Notion, Figma, you know, GitHub's kind of shipping features, like, it's right. You know, Slack, like, it's only really been, and then obviously there's, yeah, like, in terms of the early stuff, like, community, like, Discord, Slack, Reddit, Clubhouse, just tons of stuff that has really happened. And then obviously everyone's talking about like Web3 stuff. So I think there's, and, you know, potential opportunities here. It is getting easier to raise money. So, you know, I'm hopeful that over time, like, there will be, like, funding will also become non-binary in the sense that it won't just be bootstrapping and VC. It'll be like crowdfunding or like raising a small, you know, angel round, and, you know, friends, your community, et cetera, et cetera. So I hope that that becomes more possible, because I don't think there's anything wrong with raising money, but I do think most businesses probably don't need the, you know, the 1000x VC return style investment, right? Like, right. Just most businesses aren't looking for that. So, but most retail investors, I think, would be happy with a 10x, you know.
Yes, I think there's also the question of
phenomenal public investment.
Yeah, and I guess there's also the question of sort of fund economics, right? So with these guys raising bigger and bigger, like, pre-seed and seed funds and that sort of thing, you know, every investment they make needing to be a fund returner just means, like, the winners need to look bigger and bigger. And I guess that means there's space for other people in the market and other sort of return profiles. I mean, you're an LP in one of the Calm Investing.
Yeah, Calm Company Fund. I really think they're basically the only ones in the game doing it at scale. It's still so early, I think, for that way of funding startups, and that they, you know, they kind of have like a different kind of return profile. So we'll see. But it is, yeah, it is. I personally think, like, what the most important thing is now, you know, founders can build audiences, right? Like, everything else stems from that point of leverage. So I think as long as people are focused on, like, building audiences and, like, providing value and being helpful, I think your options will be much broader in terms of raising venture or raising bootstrapping or raising a crowdfunding round, or all of these things become far easier when you have, you know, an audience of people that you've, like, built real relationships and trust with, right? Like, today, if I wanted to start a new company, I could raise a seed round for it probably in a tweet. And
yes, yeah,
I think that's pretty powerful.
You raised your rolling fund with, like, a Notion memo and a Zoom call, right? And I guess the crowdfund for Gumroad was pretty rapid as well.
Yeah, basically, I mean, I have the same sort of, you know, it's funny, like, the playbook that I was doing when I was 14, like, it's not that different today. I obviously, maybe a little bit more scale, but ultimately it's sort of the same thing, which is I do, you know, I build something or write something, like, let's say a blog post, then I, you know, I send it to a bunch of people, get feedback, make it better, hopefully. But then I basically just share with my audience. I put it in, you know, I try to post it on Hacker News or like one of these communities that I think it would resonate within. And yeah, you know, it's basically just turns an outbound sales function into an inbound marketing function, right? Like I talk about in the book, like instead of pitching 100 investors on Zoom, I just say, hey, if you want to invest, here's a document, here's a video, click this link, you know, and if you need more than that, the answer is no, you don't want, you shouldn't invest, you know? Yeah, I think the crowdfunding round was 5 million from 7,000 people in 12 hours. The rolling fund is now, I don't know how big it is, but it's like $12 million a year, I think, changes every quarter. Yeah, that was basically raised through, you know, Twitter. And I have this Notion memo. It's public. Anyone can read it. So yeah, I really believe, you know, I think there's reasons that more people don't copy me. I wish more people did, to be honest, but yeah.
What do you think those reasons are?
It saves me a lot of time. I mean, the biggest reason is people just don't want to be that transparent. It's not, you know, it's not easy. I don't know if easy is the right word, but it's certainly not normal to basically tell all of your prospective LPs, and not only that, but the entire world, like your, you know, historical investments, how well they've done, how you think about investing in founders, why you're going to win those deals, how you're going to find them, how you're uniquely differentiated, what the terms of your fund are, how many investments you're going to be doing, you know, like just basically just the deck that, you know, you would share with LPs. Like, I just think people just generally aren't willing to share those ideas more broadly. I think maybe because they're not proud of them, or maybe because they're not that good, or maybe because they're afraid of being copied by somebody else. I also think there's kind of this, and this is definitely kind of a theme of the kind of the minimalist entrepreneurs, you know, sales is often this information asymmetry, right? Where you're like, for example, the used car salesperson knows more about the car than you do. It's just kind of a crappy negotiation whenever that happens. This also happens, by the way, with startups, right? Because like generally the VC actually knows less than the founder does. And so the VC is always like kind of cautious about, well, what don't I know about this, right? And the way I operate is just very different, which is like, here's everything, you know?
So you write about this in your company culture. You guys, you do it pretty much publicly now as well. It's sort of sharing all of your numbers. Even the salaries of all the employees are shared with all the other employees, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which I honestly think is insane that not every company does this. Like, it's so obviously better to me. Like, it's not even negotiable or debatable for me how awesome that is.
Because as a system, it just creates more, you reach the optimal faster by sharing more information. Is that how you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of different reasons. I mean, one is that it just is a lot less work for me, right? Because anytime someone wants to negotiate, they can like go look at the data themselves and realize that it's actually quite efficient. There is no real discrepancy here. If there were, it would be very obvious to everybody, right? The other great thing is, you know, if someone says, hey, I deserve a raise, it's like, cool, like go convince, like, why are you talking to me? I don't have any special data to say that you deserve it or not. Like, go talk to somebody else. And if you can convince them, then, you know, I'm happy to revisit this, right? So you can basically outsource. Like, transparency is about outsourcing to me, right? Like, if I'm the only one that knows something, then I can't outsource it inherently, right? Because I'm the only one that knows it. But if I tell the world how to do something, or say, hey, here's my fund memo, anyone can read it, I effectively outsource the work to the reader, you know? So it saves me. It's like very selfish, actually. Like, it saves me like an insane amount of time. Like, I'll wake up and be like, oh wow, I have like $300,000 more dollars to deploy in startups because like two LPs signed up because I had some viral tweet, and then they went to my website, and then, you know, some tiny percentage of people went to my website from that, and then, you know, 30 some people clicked the fund memo, and it's just a funnel, right? And then at the bottom they were like, well, you know, they read everything that they maybe Googled around a little bit, they were like, wow, this is awesome, they went to AngelList, they sent me an email or what have you, and like it's just you want to allow people to basically get all the way through your sales funnel without you even being a part of it. Like, I think that's the goal.
Agreed.
And I've just done that. But yeah, I do think like the thing that I don't really say is that you have to be really good for this model to work, right? Like right. most venture funds, if they did this, it would not work because they would just not be that interesting. Right.
Yes. I mean, you need this audience, right? Which goes back to your marketing point, you know, sort of like you need to think about this funnel of or process of educate, inspire, entertain, you know, gradually build up your skills doing those things. And ultimately, you may be very good or you may not be that good at that, I guess. And then if you're able to build a big audience, you can do this stuff, right? And then if you can't build a big audience, then you're less able to do this stuff.
Yeah. And honestly, the size, I don't think is super relevant. Like my guess is like my fund would be roughly the same size if I had 10,000 followers because those 10,000 followers were all startup people, right? Now that I have like 250,000 followers, like my guess is most of those people don't have capital to deploy in startups right. and these sorts of things. Right. So there's, it's kind of asymptotic in that way where you're like the first 5,000 people that followed me were like, the you know Silicon Valley type of
and people. They're all your LPs in your fund
and they're yeah basically like those are right. most of my LPs are people that I've known for 10 years right
and that's sort
it
of
takes
your,
time
your,
I think you can't really skip that
they're sort of your friends or acquaintances they know you they trust you like all of that sort of thing I guess
yeah and I mean ultimately I think at the end of the day like there's this myth that you can just burst onto the scene and like you know, it's purely based on, you know, your product or, you know, how impressive you are in that 1 hour meeting or whatever, which is, again, it is true for like very few people, but for most people, like you need to build trust. Like it doesn't come for free and it takes a lot of time and there's no way to skip that time. It's kind of like sauteing onions or something like that. Right. Like you just got to wait. And, I think it's to build a quality of audience. You just need like, I wouldn't even say it's like, you know, 5 years or something like that, but like at least a couple years. And you know, my question to people is always just, you know, when people are like impatient, they're like, oh, well I have the stuff. Like why, you know, why not now or whatever? And it's like, well, there's no proof that you actually like doing this. Like why do you even want to commit to this? You've only been doing it for a year, right? How it's kind of like, I don't know, getting married after a year dating or something. I don't know, but like, why, how are you so certain? Like, I just don't believe that you can be so certain because like things change. And if you've been doing it for 5 years, then the chances are you'll be doing it for another 5 years. If you've been doing it for one day, the chances are you'll be doing it for another one day, you know, like sort of the Lindy law. So
yes,
you know, if you've been doing it for 15 years, like this, I say this all the time, like the reason, you know, when I was able to raise money for Gumroad and the crowdfunding round, you know, I obviously there's like, it's a very high risk investment, et cetera, et cetera. But I said, look, Gumroad's been around for 10 years. So
chances are we're going to be around in 10 years. Well, it's much higher than someone else who hasn't been around for 10 years, right?
Exactly. Yeah. If you're comparing Gumroad to the average 2-year-old startup, like it's just, you know, a couple orders of magnitude difference in terms of, will we be around in 10 years, which, you know, for better or worse, like we're much more stable. We're also much less likely to probably build a $100 billion company or something like that. But we are, much more likely to stick around.
That being said, your growth seems to really, you know, I guess all of those years, it's really starting to compound now. Like I was looking at those numbers for the last, you know, year or two, it's really shot up in terms of where you're at now and in terms of revenue and profit, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously COVID was a good year for many creator economy companies. Now, I think COVID is really the reason that people even use the term creator economy, which is great for us. But it was a great year. I mean, I think the last 4 years were 15% year-over-year growth, 25%, 40%. And then last year was 85, 87%. And you know, it basically just goes back to that, you know, I'm so glad that I wrote that essay because it checks out pretty well. Like, it's like, hey, look, it turns out the market does determine your growth. Like the market had a crazy year and we grew 87%. Like there's no way Gumroad, you know, as a team, as a product, as a company could have done anything to grow that quickly. right? That was purely a macro decision.
And you've done that with sort of no meetings, no deadlines, no full-time employees, you know, completely async, like this whole thing. Maybe talk a little bit about that. I mean, I had one question on this actually. So you've sort of got everyone part-time now, right? And everyone sort of checks in and works when they want. 40 people. Right. Is there any issue with part-time teams like not tackling complex projects well? So I think Josh Pickford wrote about this and said they went from part-time back to full-time due to this issue of like the more complex projects not getting completed.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we just shipped this rebrand. We changed the logo, the whole website, the product, like every pixel, basically. We wrote all the copy of the whole web. Thank you. Yeah, we you know, revisited every line of copy, all the illustrations, like our socials, like everything. And we did it with, you know, in this way. So I think it's certainly possible. I think you have to hire a certain type of person. You do have to adopt a certain way of working that I think, you know, the difference with maybe Josh's startup, which I'm an investor in, maybe is that they're just very early. And so I think there's a lot of this kind of pre-product market fit sort of stuff that they really need to figure out, which just requires a lot more, I think, conversation back and forth, riffing, trying stuff, talk, you know, that sort of thing. And I think it's just a lot more ambiguous what they need to build. And I think in that case, then yeah, like you actually probably don't want more than like six people in the whole company. Like, I think it's really important to figure this stuff out at like a pretty small scale before you commit. But then, yeah, my guess is, and I was actually talking to a startup, you know, in person, ironically, yesterday. And you know, my thinking is that, you know, they're in person, and my thinking is that you want to be in person until you have product market fit. Once you have product market fit, I think it matters much, much, much less. Is my guess that sort of is like an inflection point for the company. So, for example, if I started a new company, I would consider, I don't know what I would do, but I would consider getting an office somewhere and then having, you know, people work out of it. And as a way to motivate me, as a way to motivate them, a way to just build the culture of the company earlier and sooner. But I think Gumroad is just in a different place where we just don't have to do those sort of, honestly, I'm very glad that I'm not starting a company today, because it feels hard. If you know, back then, you know, 5 years ago, it was easy. Like, you get an office and everyone works in the office, like, cool, done, right? And nowadays it's a lot more.
Everyone wants to be remote, don't they?
Yeah.
I think I saw
that's the other thing. That's the other thing that people need to, you know, it doesn't really matter what the companies want.
What do the good people want, right?
Exactly.
And in terms of your hiring process now and things being async, and, you know, I guess there's certain, you know, you've built, I guess, a cultural DNA over time of the sorts of people you're looking for. And, you know, you publicize that and make it very known, you know, who Gumroad people are and who they're not. How do you identify that in the people you hire?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it comes down to their writing ability. Like, I find, you know, there's probably a lot of bias that I have here, because I enjoy writing a lot, and I think it's important. I think writing is huge. Like, just when people email in, like, for example, if you say, you know, hey, I want to work at Gumroad, here's my resume, let me know if you have any open positions. Like, you're not going to get the job at Gumroad, right? Because you haven't done what a CEO does, which is like, you actually have to like sell yourself a little bit, right? Like, you don't raise money by saying, hey, I'm raising money for my startup, here's the deck, let me know, right? Like, that doesn't generally work. But if you say, hey, I think Gumroad's really cool, I actually use Gumroad, I've made a little bit of money, here's my product, you know, here are some bugs that I found, by the way, that I love to fix if you consider hiring me, you know, like that. Honestly, I would say that like less than 10% of the emails I get are the second type of email. Like 90% of the emails I get are, and this, so by the way, isn't
instant
for
filter
hiring.
for the top 10% almost. Sorry, this, by the way, is
I'm starting Yeah, that's how I think about it. Is I basically every filter is sort of a, you know, kind of a 10% filter. And yeah, basically right out the bat, 90% of people don't make it through the first filter, and then maybe, you know, 90% of people don't make it through the rest of the filter. And so therefore we hire, I would say roughly the kind of the top 1% of people who kind of enter the funnel, maybe even less these days. So it's a very, you know, this is the thing that's, you know, again, like Gumroad is a very unusual company, but we hire very, very selectively. And this no meetings, no deadlines, no full-time employees, like maybe the only way that that model works is if you're hiring the top 1% of people, right? Which inherently means you have to have 100 applicants per job, right?
Right.
Otherwise, you're right. Not really able to hire, and, you know, the top 1%.
And to keep the quality high, I guess you have to hire, you know, expensive people as well.
Yeah, totally. I mean,
your hourly rates are pretty high for engineers.
Yeah, we pay them worldwide. So if you're, you know, in theory, if you're in Thailand,
Ukraine or somewhere, right?
Or Ukraine, or yeah, literally, you know, I don't know what the cheapest, you know, Zambia or whatever, like you can make $200,000 a year working at Gumroad. And, you know, it's but you know, even then, I will say, even then, we're not getting, you know, hammered by applicants. Like the truth is, like the amount of people who are at that skill level in all the ways that we need them to be and know that government exists and want this kind of job, you know, it's still early days, I think. Which is kind of the bet that we're making now as a company. It's kind of what I wrote about when I wrote the blog post on the rebrand. But yeah, the biggest bet that we're making as a company is that this is, I wouldn't say the future, but a future of how we work and how we create and how we live and work and earning an income.
And stuff. I mean, there's a lot of hype in Web3, right? In terms of like DAOs and, you know, that sort of thing. But if you look at what you guys are doing, it's very much in the spirit of the open source movement. I saw you wrote before you were even planning to open source a version of Gumroad. I don't know if you're still planning to do that or if you did it.
We're still planning to at some point. Yeah.
Right. But then also sort of in terms of how you work, it's very like, you know, working for a DAO, I guess, would be in terms of like work when you want, you know, if you contribute and create value, then you get paid well. I don't think it needs to be built on a blockchain to work, that sort of stuff. And yeah, I fully agree with you. It does feel like the world is moving in that direction.
Yeah, I kind of jokingly call it like the web 2.1 way of working, which is, you know, we basically take, at least the way that I like to think about it, is we take the good parts of Web3, mostly the discourse, less so the technology, like the kind of cultural aspect of it. And then just say, yeah, okay, cool. Like we can adopt some of these principles. But ultimately, I mean, if you want to draw the line out into the future, like the future, you know, 2030, 2040, et cetera, is like basically everyone works for themselves. Like there's just a million, you know, 7 billion companies with one employee each, and you know,
which Gumroad, I think people forget, was
an extreme version of that,
which I think people forget was, you know, the way until maybe 150 200 years ago as well, right? And then you know, things sort of changed with the Industrial Revolution,
and mostly the LLC, right? I mean, the LLC is really what created this in sort of new business structure that allowed many people to work together. I mean, but you know, because before the LLC, you know, for folks who don't know, like basically limited liability corporation, like means that, you know, before the LLC, it means like, let's say we started a business together and then the business failed. The people like,
we're not liable for any of the debts in the business, basically.
Yeah. Before LLC, like it literally meant that like you could, you know, it basically meant that you would only start a business with people that you were 100% sort of trusted, aligned with, effectively only family businesses existed at that point, because you never start a business with somebody else that you didn't know. And limited liability and all the other stuff that happened after that point, you know, started, I think, in New York. Like it's, I mean, even, you know, the fact that New York is this like the financial capital of the world, and like that's also where the LLC started, right? Like it might not be a coincidence.
Yeah, no. I agree. I think you're right. And you know, it seems like, you know, what's happening in the crypto world is potentially you know, the next phase in the evolution of this. But you know, as you point out, I think it's more about the culture than it is about the technology that underpins this. And the culture now is one of sort of like solo capitalists, and then finding your community and working together with your community to build something for people, right? And I mean, going back to some of the other stuff you've mentioned, you know, in terms of like everyone starting a company nowadays and maybe it being more challenging, it does strike me that maybe community is like the one thing that I think, you know, our head of community said he was talking to someone who's a YC-backed company recently who are very focused on community. And they were sort of saying, look, it's the one thing that isn't replicable, right? Like everything else can be built by someone else and copied very quickly nowadays. And, you know, you can do it all with software. So it feels like that's the one thing that really sets you apart as a business nowadays.
Yeah, definitely in the beginning. I think in the beginning of the business, I mean, ultimately relationships, right? Like whether it be customers or community or employees or, you know, it's really just who you know and who knows you is what's going to set you apart in the beginning. Your skill set matters, but I think it's almost easier to, like, you know, if you have a good skill set, I can just look at who you know or who knows you, right? Like if you're a good writer, I don't need to actually know if you're a good writer. I can just see how many people have read your work, right? Mm-hmm. If a lot of people read your work, then I can assume that you're a good writer in a sense, or, you know, a certain kind of writer at least. I would say, you know, later stage, like one of the reasons we did the rebrand is I do think in a super saturated industry in which, you know, things are less differentiated over time, which is great because it means, like, you know, better tools for the end customers, then I do think brand does become a larger part. And I do think that is unreplicable in the sense, but it's for the exact same reason, which is the brand exists in everybody else's head. So it's just a more scaled community sort of relationship angle, right? Like Gumroad as a brand is just software, you know, running in a bunch of brains, you know, based on a bunch of stories or sentences or anecdotes or whatever that they've experiences that they've had. And no one can steal that, right? It's not like you can sort of Patreon, and we can't steal anyone else's, right? Everyone has to build their own sort of mountain. And brand, I think, is kind of like the end state of that, which is when you buy Nikes, right? Like, what do you
buy? It's community at scale, almost, in a way, isn't it? Like, sort of emotions, culture, relationships, all of that human stuff.
It's like a jersey. I mean, you know, like, obviously, when you support Barcelona or whatever, like, you're not really part of a community in the sense that you know everybody, but certainly, you know, there is a certain feeling of camaraderie and similarity, and the fact that you have this shared set of values or goals or experiences in the past, and you know certain things, and you speak certain languages, and, you know, lingo.
It's a shared narrative, isn't it? I guess it's just like nationality, right? Like, what binds Americans, and then when you're abroad, like, if someone else is from the States, you may be more likely to be like, oh, you guys are from the States as well, blah blah blah, you know, you sort of start talking. I think that sort of share, what's shared there is sort of a fiction that's created in those people's heads, right? But it has real intrinsic value in the real world.
Well, I mean, ultimately, it doesn't have any intrinsic value, right? I mean, the beauty, or like the weird thing, and I think the reason that people have a really hard time wrapping their heads around culture generally, but NFTs and Web3 is an example of culture. Like, for example, I'm like, I don't know why anyone would support a team. Like, I have no idea why you support a sports team or anything like that. But I see that people do, and they've created that value kind of in their own heads. But that's fine. Like, that's enough to make it work for them. And I do think it leads to, like, less war, you know, like,
Sorry, that's what I meant by the intrinsic, or not intrinsic, maybe I mean extrinsic. I what I mean is, it has physical repercussions in the real world.
Totally.
Even though I agree with you, it's a fiction, and you sort of think, why are these people all following this thing sort of blindly, right?
Exactly. But it's super important. I mean, ultimately, And this is the thing that I think technologists like me, or what, you know, people who build stuff primarily, you know, it's tough to wrap our heads around, but like the truth is, like, many more people care about that soft sense of value. And you need that to corral a bunch of people to do something good for the world in a way, yes. right? Like, you can't yes. just build a product and say, oh, everyone should be using Twitter. Like, you kind of have to, you know, for example, I think the best company in the world at this historically is at least my perspective, is Apple, where Apple really created, in my view, a movement around how everyone, you know, the personal computer will effectively unlock the creativity in every single person. And, you know, we need to like worship the weirdos and these sorts of things. And they pulled it off. Right. I mean, or maybe Nike with, you know, getting a bunch of people into athletics or what have you, right. Considering themselves athletes when they may not have otherwise. But they didn't do it because the computers were awesome. Right. Or they didn't do it because the shoes were better. They did it because they were, you know, they wanted to be part of something larger than themselves. Yeah. Like, I think you said, like a new religion almost. And you know, the most famous book on this, right, is Sapiens. Another really amazing one, I think, is that I think highlights this trend to a degree is The Sovereign Individual, which basically has kind of this thesis that like the nation state is on its way out and will be replaced. You know, this book was written like in the '80s or something, but
interesting. What Balaji spends all his time talking about now, and a lot of people in Silicon Valley, it seems, is
If you like what Balaji says, like, just read The Sovereign Individual, because it's all from that book. I mean, it's just that book. But yeah, you know, that book talks about, you know, internet money. I think it's called e-money or something like that. Before, you know, obviously before the Bitcoin white paper and all these sorts of things. Like,
Have you ever read The Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson?
Yeah, totally. Long time.
He also sort of buys into that philosophy, right, of society, I guess, sort of like unbundling and rebundling around new values. You know, there's this group that are Victorians, right? And then another group that are like, you know, the communists or whatever. It does feel like it's moving in that direction, driven by
the internet. Ultimately, like, it's kind of like the two-party system in America, right? Like, we will always have, like, the rules kind of define the players and the way the game is played. And ultimately, the rules create this binary two-party system. And you see this everywhere. I mean, you see this with Pepsi, Coke, Uber, Lyft. Like, it's not restricted to just like Democrats and Republicans or Victorians and communists. Like, we just fundamentally think in binaries. Like, we just do. Binaries are just built into us to a pretty deep level. Like, you can say something exists, you can say something doesn't exist, but there's no way, like, that's kind of it, you know. It's very interesting, but I do think that like community and these sorts of things will be the, you know, over time people will associate with them quite, you know, basically as strongly as they may with like a country. Like, I think the biggest thing that people, you know, there's two big things. The sovereign individual, like the main thesis of it, besides the, you know, the, or at least the kind of the sub thesis of it, or like, why is the nation state even important today? Like, what does it mean to lose that, is basically like the monopoly on violence. Like, effectively, governments are the only ones that are legally kind of almost like allowed to be violent. So effectively, like, the power structure is basically defined by who has the ability to be violent. And currently that's the nation state, right? America or China or Russia or what have you. Before, it was like the British Empire, right? Before the British Empire, it was like tribes, you know? So again, kind of unbundle. But I think we'll end up where we started, which is every single person is kind of almost on their own, and, you know, is kind of working with the people that they want to work with. Like, you know, 100 years from now, I don't think we will have countries and armies of countries. We will have something that to people in 2021 would probably sound pretty dystopian and pretty scary. But I think in the new world, the kind of the technology and rules will be defined in a way that it will make more sense, and it'll actually be a better world for everybody. Like, for example, like a world without policing might sound scary to a lot of people, but also, like, a world without violence would make that okay.
Right.
So that, you know, the question is like, how do we get to a world without violence? Which
So do you buy into that sort of like, I guess, ultra libertarian mindset of how the world could and should operate? I guess it's the sort of Atlas Shrugged sort of.
Yeah,
mindset.
I mean, I think it's kind of paradoxical. Like, I believe in free markets, but then I believe in the ability for free markets to construct, you know, non-free markets in a sense, right? Like, I believe in the ability for a union to form within a free market because I believe in the ability for people to do whatever they want. And so, you know, part of that is they have the ability to. So I think it's tricky to say like, well, what, you know, again, it's kind of like the unbundling thing. Like, I think the right answer is we allow for experimentation. And
I think that's the problem nowadays is there's not enough room for experimentation. And I think it's governments have a monopoly, not just on violence, but on like land as well. And on law.
Totally.
So you can just, you can't, you know, I guess with crypto, what's interesting is people have just decided, all right, fuck it. We're just going to ignore these rules and do whatever we want. And then they're like, oh, some of this stuff is working. And, you know, maybe it ends up being better.
I saw some interesting thing that said, basically, maybe it was from Balaji, I don't know, but basically it said, like, if you wanted to build, like, if Zuck wanted to assemble, like, his own country and with his own army, you know, because effectively that'd be the first thing you'd have to figure out, because if you did do this, you would literally be at war with somebody, right? Because all the land is owned. So you have to pick an enemy, and the US is not going to be cool with you doing this, right? The UN is not going to endorse like a new country. Like, it doesn't matter.
I think so.
How awesome the, you know, Barack Obama's doing it or whatever, right? Like, it's not going to fly. But and I think the math was something like $2 to $4 billion is what it would cost to kind of set up like a sort of an army that had any chance of being legitimate. And like, that's doable today, to be honest.
You could crowdfund that, man.
Seriously. So, you know, just like all technology, you know, the goal of technology is kind of this deflationary thing, right? Where things should get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper over time. You know, maybe starting a country would have cost $1 trillion and then $100 billion and then $10 billion and now, you know, $2 to $4 billion. And, you know, I think over time, we will need this level of experimentation. And I do think that, you know, like it will be dystopian, and just like an Atlas Shrugged, there's like 100 people, you know, who kind of like reach that level. And the truth is, like, most people just, the world would be worse for most people in that world. Like, I think most people would not benefit from a libertarian kind of society. Certainly some people would tremendously, you know, but those people are also, you know, probably on the head of the, you know, their IQs are sort of super on the right tail, side of the distribution. But, like, they have a lot of money. Like,
a society that values that as like almost like ethically better, right? Like, meritocracy is good. Have you ever read that? I think it was in The Atlantic, The War on Dumb People. Have you ever read that?
I haven't.
Or
The
War on Stupid People. Something.
No,
like that.
I haven't.
But yeah, I mean, so when they introduced the idea of meritocracy originally, I think it was in some piece of fiction, and it was portrayed as like, is this, you know, sort of like moral? You know, and they were sort of saying like, no, it's not. But it's definitely moved in that direction now. I don't know. I think it's an interesting.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, like, you know, I sort of think of myself as like either communist or libertarian, depending on the issue. Like, for example, like I do believe in sort of like more free market principles. Like, I don't believe in a minimum wage. Like, I don't believe in a government setting a minimum wage. I grew up in Singapore, which is a country that does not have a minimum wage. So it's like, people are like, that's extreme. I'm like, I literally grew up in a country that doesn't have one. So it's not extreme at all.
But Singapore is an interesting mix of like communist-ish principles and then libertarianism. And what's he called? The founding sort of father of Singapore. He was like a communist in his early years. He was a communist in his like youth, right? When he was like 19 or 20 or something like that. And then he sort of pivoted.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, like, you know, Singapore is just kind of relatively pragmatic. Like, they don't have a strong. I mean, this is the beauty of authoritarianism is you don't need to appeal to the people's ideologies as much. The US just is kind of stuck because you cannot win the race without doing that. And then apparently you can't do anything interesting if you did that.
Yeah, you end up between a rock and a hard place, don't you? Can't do anything.
Exactly. Yeah, you kind of have to rewrite. I have some ideas on how to do that, but you have to kind of rewrite the rules of the system before the players change. And I think
create a new game almost.
Yeah, but then, you know, so I'm sort of no minimum wage, but then also, like, I believe everyone should have one vote, which is, like, inherently communist, right? Like, why does everyone deserve an equal vote, right? Like literally, I believe, like, babies should be able to vote. Like, like maybe their vote is delegated to their...
Thinking, acting...
I think if you have four kids, the system, you deserve four votes until they're 18 or whatever, something like that.
Right.
And I'm sure people will say that's idea. Insane.
Well, but how do you test that?
Well, yeah, it's funny because, Democrats are like, well, you know, we want more people to vote, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, like, let's let 4-year-olds vote. And they're like, no, that's not cool. And I'm like, well, that's anti-democratic to me. You're saying that these people can't vote based on something they can't change about themselves. Like, that seems ageist, you know? I'm being a little bit annoying, but it's worth, I just think these ideas, like, it's like, they're almost like blasphemy in a sense. Like you can't even talk about them to get to the legitimate conclusion that they're stupid. Like you just have to say that they're stupid without actually having explored the topic whatsoever.
Well, that's because you just have to adhere to the dogma of like wherever you supposedly align politically, right? There's not really a room for people to explore things, to question things, to like politics. They don't A/B test anything, right? So like, how can you know if something's better?
Yeah, it's unfalsifiable, for sure. I mean, the other thing is, you know, we were talking about community and how important it was. And like, the truth is politics is a huge community. So most people want to be liked by people, right? Like I also feel comfortable, sort of having these views publicly because I have, you know, don't need that, right? Like I have my friends, I have my family, I have a successful business with customers and I have a track record. Like, I know that if I say these things, I'm not going to get canceled tomorrow. But if you're like beginning your career and you're trying to get a job and you don't know a bunch of people and, you know, you moved countries recently, then what do? You learn the language, you buy the jerseys, you go to the local bar, you know, like you want to be you don't want to be an outsider. Mm. You want to be an insider. Right. And so I think it's almost like a point of privilege that I get to.
Right.
You know, you have to kind of get somewhere before you can kind of start saying, well, actually, like, you know, it kind of goes back to your point around venture, right? Like, I get to do this because I did raise venture, right? Like, I became an insider, I played the game, and that almost gives me the, not permission, but it gives me kind of the authority to say, hey, maybe there's like, you know, there's some nuance here. Right. But people, frankly, wouldn't listen to me. This is kind of the ironic thing about my book and the blog post is like people wouldn't listen to me unless I had raised venture funding. So it kind of like, it's kind of this weird thing where like everyone's like, oh, this is awesome because this is like proof that venture funding doesn't, you know, need to exist or like whatever, it's bad or whatever. But like, actually the reason you're reading this article, you wouldn't have read this article unless I had raised a Series A from Kleiner at 19 years old. Like,
that's all part of the story and the journey and everything, right? Like,
exactly. There's so many, imagine someone bootstrapped a company and then wrote an article called Reflecting on My Failure to Build a $1 billion Company.
People like, will be like, what else, mate?
Yeah. It's like, you and everybody else, right. Or whatever. Right? But like, it's the fact that I did it so publicly and I kind of raised money from people who are pretty good at predicting $1 billion companies, et cetera. And, and you know, that sort of, you know, Icarus flew too close to the sun sort of story that I think is what appealed to many, many people.
Well, look, I mean, like you say, it puts you in this position now, which is a privilege. I think the good thing is that you do go out and talk about this stuff, right? Like with, you know, to quote Spider-Man, with great power comes a great responsibility.
I try.
You know, I think it's good. And it's like the ethical and moral thing to do. I actually had a question on this. I appreciate we've run over a little bit. Have you got things to dash off to?
In a second, I should, yeah.
All right. One question I had, are you religious? I saw you go to church every Sunday or did when you were living in Provo. Is that more about community or is that something that came to you later in life?
Yeah, mostly about community and just learning. I just love learning, and I honestly love being an outsider. So every time I become an insider, I'm like, how do I become an outsider again? Because that's where I think it's almost like a challenge in a sense. Like, how do I figure out this new world and system, and whether mm-hmm. that be science fiction, fantasy writing, or painting, mm-hmm. oil painting, or Mormonism, or filmmaking in LA, or mm-hmm. Portland now. Like, I just, I'm constantly interested in, and just like figuring out how like these kind of social structures and stuff like that, like a little game or something. But yeah, I mean, I did it mostly for that, just for the kind of community and learning. I did get baptized, but I didn't stick around too long. But it was, yeah, it was very, very interesting. I think Mormonism is like a phenomenal example of like this modern day community of 15 million people. I think it is, I guess, depending on who you ask, that like is very aligned, like very culturally homogenous, which I think is quite interesting in this day and age that they've been able to kind of keep that. And so I think it's like underrated in terms of
built
of
on that, a pretty crazy, a crazy founding story, right? Have you ever seen
the... Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, obviously, I think America's founding story is like the, one of the craziest, but definitely... this sort of, I mean, Mormonism is like the American religion, right?
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
It's very sort of American, you know, and so, yeah, there's a lot of similarities, and there's, yeah, there's a lot of good. There's obviously a lot of bad. Like, I believe like centralized power, you know, is not great. And certainly the Mormonism has a lot of centralized, super centralized power. So I think that just generally leads to issues. It doesn't matter how great the people are. Like, part of the reason I share all the stuff is because I don't want all the power. Like, I don't want to be the single person that only knows certain things and gets to make decisions nobody else can. Like, I just, I don't really want that. In the same way that maybe other people do.
The interesting thing in the internet age is that seems to make you accrue more power. So like by becoming a channel for all of this information, people just start following you, and then you end up with more power as a result. But maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a good
I mean, the way that I think about it,
the internet.
Yeah, I've definitely kind of had a similar thought. I'm like, this is interesting. Like, I'm basically, you know, it's funny. Like, people are like, wow, you're railing on all these VCs. It's like really cool that you're doing that from like, you know, as an underdog. And I'm like, actually, I have more followers than all of them combined at this point. You know, most of them combined at this point. Like, you know, it's just maybe not Mark Andreessen or whatever, but a lot of the other ones. And like, yeah, it is kind of funny, but the way that I like to think about it, maybe I'm just justifying it to myself, but the way I think about it is it's earned power. Like, these people are choosing to give me the power to do this, whether that means, you know, social media reach or capital in the form of crowdfunding or what have you, but it's all super opt-in, super consensual, you know, information symmetry, et cetera, versus old structures of power that I think, I mean, they were probably still opt-in to some degree, but you know, not so much. Or maybe it was like 100 people, you know, got to decide that this person was interesting.
Yeah. And there's more room for abuse. There's more room for abuse of power under that system because it's less transparent, right?
And you know, the beauty of my audience is that, and my power is that it can be taken away from me. Like, it's harder to take it away because it, like, more people have to agree at the same time, in a sense. But if the power should be taken away from me, I think it's like a much more efficient system, right? Like, I think I would be like, let's say I did something, I don't know, fraudulent or something
like,
around
it's government. It's like liquid democracy, like, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's you know, it's very American, right? Like, it's in that way, it's sort of, you get the extremes, and hopefully you want that. So.
Yeah. So, well, look, and Neil, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
I feel like we just started to get into the conversation and start discussing interesting stuff rather than repeating all the same stuff you have to on every podcast.
That's how it goes.
Look, thank you so much. Everyone can buy your book, The Minimalist Entrepreneur, which is out now. They can follow you on Twitter. You want to say a few words about anything before you go?
Yeah, and check out the new Gumroad brand. We just shipped this awesome new rebrand, Gumroad, GUMROAD.com. I think it's pretty dope. And my Twitter is @SHL.